There was something odd about the horse, but he couldn't say what. Well, there was one thing that was clearly very odd about it indeed, which is that it was standing in a college bathroom. Maybe that was all. He reached out, rather tentatively, to pat the creature on its neck. It felt normal, firm, glossy, it was in good condition. The effect of the moonlight on its coat was a little mazy, but everything looks a little odd by moonlight. The horse shook its mane a little when he touched it, but didn't seem to mind too much. After the success of patting it, Richard stroked it a few times, and scratched it gently under the jaw. Then he noticed that there was another door into the bathroom, in the far corner. He moved cautiously around the horse and approached the other door. He backed up against it, and pushed it open tentatively. It just opened into the professor's bedroom, a small room cluttered with books and shoes and a small, single bed. This room, too, had another door which opened out onto the landing again. Richard noticed that the floor of the landing was newly scuffed and scratched as the stairs had been, and these marks were consistent with the idea that the horse had somehow been pushed up the stairs. He wouldn't have liked to have had to do it himself, and would have liked to have been the horse having it done to him even less, but it was just about possible. But why? He had one last look at the horse, which had one last look back at him, and then he returned downstairs. "I agree," he said. "You have a horse in your bathroom, and I will, after all, have a little port." He poured some for himself and then some for Reg, who was quietly contemplating the fire and was in need of a refill. "Just as well I did put out three glasses after all," said Reg chattily. "I wondered why earlier, and now I remember. You asked if you could bring a friend, but appear not to have done so, on account of the sofa, no doubt. Never mind, these things happen. Whoa, not too much, you'll spill it." All horse-related questions left Richard's mind abruptly. "I did?" he said. "Oh yes, I remember now. You rang me back to ask me if it'd be all right, as I recall. I said I would be charmed, and fully intended to be." "I'd saw the thing up if I were you. Don't want to sacrifice your happiness to a sofa. Or maybe she decided that an evening with your old tutor would be blisteringly dull and opted for the more exhilarating course of washing her hair instead. Dear me, I know what I would have done. It's only lack of hair that forces me to pursue such a hectic social round these days." It was Richard's turn to be white-faced and staring. Yes, he had assumed that Susan would not want to come. Yes, he had said to her it would be terribly dull, but she had insisted that she wanted to come because it would be the only way she'd get to see his face for a few minutes, not bathed in the light of a computer screen. So he had agreed and arranged that he would bring her after all. Only he had completely forgotten this. He had not picked her up. He said, "Can I use your phone, please?" Chapter 9. Gordon Way lay on the ground, unclear about what to do. He was dead. There seemed little doubt about that. There was a horrific hole in his chest, but the blood that was gobbing out of it had slowed to a trickle. Otherwise, there was no movement from his chest at all, or indeed from any other part of him. He looked up, and from side to side, and it became clear to him that whatever part of him it was that was moving, it wasn't any part of his body. The mist rolled slowly over him and explained nothing. At a few feet distant from him, his shotgun lay smoking quietly in the grass. He continued to lie there, like someone lying awake at 4 o'clock in the morning, unable to put their mind at rest, but unable to find anything to do with it. He realized that he had just had something of a shock, which might account for his inability to think clearly, but didn't account for his ability actually to think at all. In the great debate that has raged for centuries about what, if anything, happens to you after death, be it heaven, hell, purgatory, or extinction, one thing has never been in doubt: that you would at least know the answer when you were dead. Gordon Way was dead, but he simply hadn't the faintest idea what he was meant to do about it. It wasn't a situation he had encountered before. He sat up. The body that sat up seemed as real to him as the body that still lay slowly cooling on the ground, giving up its blood heat in wraiths of steam that mingled with the mist of the chill night air. Experimenting a bit further, he tried standing up, slowly, wonderingly, and wobblingly. The ground seemed to give him support, it took his weight, but then, of course, he appeared to have no weight that needed to be taken. When he bent to touch the ground, he could feel nothing save a kind of distant, rubbery resistance, like the sensation you get if you try and pick something up when your arm has gone dead. His arm had gone dead, his legs too, and his other arm, and all his torso, and his head. His body was dead. He could not say why his mind was not. He stood in a kind of frozen, sleepless horror while the mist curled slowly through him. He looked back down at the him, the ghastly, astonished-looking him-thing, lying still and mangled on the ground, and his flesh wanted to creep. Or rather, he wanted flesh that could creep. He wanted flesh, he wanted body. He had none. A sudden cry of horror escaped from his mouth, but was nothing and went nowhere. He shook and felt nothing. Music and a pool of light seeped from his car. He walked towards it. He tried to walk sturdily, but it was a faint and feeble kind of walking, uncertain and, well, insubstantial. The ground felt frail beneath his feet. The door of the car was still open on the driver's side, as he had left it when he had leapt out to deal with the boot lid, thinking he'd only be 2 seconds. That was all of 2 minutes ago now, when he'd been alive. When he'd been a person. When he'd thought he was going to be leaping straight back in and driving off, 2 minutes and a lifetime ago. This was insane, wasn't it? He thought suddenly. He walked around the door and bent down to peer into the external rear-view mirror. He looked exactly like himself, albeit like himself after he'd had a terrible fright, which was to be expected, but that was him, that was normal. This must be something he was imagining. Some horrible kind of a waking dream. He had a sudden thought and tried breathing on the rear-view mirror. Nothing, not a single droplet formed. That would satisfy a doctor, that was what they always did on television. If no mist formed on the mirror, there was no breath. Perhaps, he thought anxiously to himself, perhaps it was something to do with having heated wing mirrors. Didn't this car have heated wing mirrors? Hadn't the salesman gone on and on about heated this, electric that, and servo-assisted the other? Maybe they were digital wing mirrors, that was it, digital, heated, servo-assisted, computer-controlled, breath-resistant wing mirrors. He was, he realised, thinking complete nonsense. He turned slowly and gazed again in apprehension at the body lying on the ground behind him with half its chest blown away. That would certainly satisfy a doctor. The sight would be appalling enough if it was somebody else's body, but his own. He was dead. 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 He tried to make the word toll dramatically in his mind, but it wouldn't. He was not a film soundtrack. He was just dead. Peering at his body in appalled fascination, he gradually became distressed by the expression of asinine stupidity on its face. It was perfectly understandable, of course. It was just such an expression as somebody who was in the middle of being shot with his own shotgun by somebody who had been hiding in the boot of his car might be expected to wear, but he nevertheless disliked the idea that anyone might find him looking like that. He knelt down beside it in the hope of being able to rearrange his features into some semblance of dignity, or at least basic intelligence. It proved to be almost impossibly difficult. He tried to knead the skin, the sickeningly familiar skin, but somehow he couldn't seem to get a proper grip on it, or on anything. It was like trying to model plasticine when your arm has gone to sleep, except that instead of his grip slipping off the model, it would slip through it. In this case, his hand slipped through his face. Nauseated horror and rage swept through him at his sheer bloody blasted impotence, and he was suddenly startled to find himself throttling and shaking his own dead body with a firm and furious grip. He staggered back in amazed shock. All he had managed to do was to add to the inanely stupefied look of the corpse a twisted-up mouth and a squint, and bruises flowering on its neck. He started to sob, and this time sound seemed to come, a strange howling from deep within whatever this thing he had become was. Clutching his hands to his face, he staggered backwards, retreated to his car, and flung himself into the seat. The seat received him in a loose and distant kind of way, like an aunt who disapproves of the last 15 years of your life and will therefore furnish you with a basic sherry but refuses to catch your eye. Could he get himself to a doctor? To avoid facing the absurdity of the idea, he grappled violently with the steering wheel, but his hands slipped through it. He tried to wrestle with the automatic transmission shift and ended up thumping it in rage, but not being able properly to grasp or push it. The stereo was still playing light orchestral music into the telephone, which had been lying on the passenger seat listening patiently all this time. He stared at it and realized with a growing fever of excitement that he was still connected to Susan's telephone answering machine. It was the type that would simply run and run until he hung up. He was still in contact with the world. He tried desperately to pick up the receiver, fumbled, let it slip, and was in the end reduced to bending himself down over its mouthpiece. "Susan!" he cried into it, his voice a hoarse and distant wail on the wind. "Susan! Help me! Help me, for God's sake, Susan! I'm dead! I'm dead! I'm dead, and I don't know what to do!" He broke down again, sobbing in desperation, and tried to cling to the phone like a baby clinging to its blanket for comfort.
"Help me, Susan," he cried again.
"Beep," said the phone. He looked down at it again where he was cuddling it. He'd managed to push something after all. He'd managed to push the button which disconnected the call. Feverishly he attempted to grapple the thing again, but it constantly slipped through his fingers and eventually lay immobile on the seat. He could not touch it. He could not push the buttons. In rage, he flung it at the windscreen. It responded to that all right. It hit the windscreen, careered straight back through him, bounced off the seat, and then lay still on the transmission tunnel, impervious to all his further attempts to touch it. For several minutes still he sat there, his head nodding slowly, as terror began to recede into blank desolation. A couple of cars passed by, but would have noticed nothing odd. A car stopped by the wayside. Passing swiftly in the night, their headlights would probably not have picked out the body lying in the grass behind the car. They certainly would not have noticed a ghost sitting inside it, crying to himself. He didn't know how long he sat there. He was hardly aware of time passing, only that it didn't seem to pass quickly. There was little external stimulus to mark its passage. He didn't feel cold. In fact, he could almost not remember what cold meant or felt like. He just knew that it was something he would have expected to feel at this moment. Eventually, he stirred from his pathetic huddle. He would have to do something, though he didn't know what. Perhaps he should try and reach his cottage, though he didn't know what he would do when he got there. He just needed something to try for. He needed to make it through the night. Pulling himself together, he slipped out of the car, his foot and knee grazing easily through part of the doorframe. He went to look again at his body, but it wasn't there. As if the night hadn't produced enough shocks already, he started and stared at the damp depression in the grass. His body was not there. Chapter 10. Richard made the hastiest departure that politeness would allow. He said thank you very much, and what a splendid evening it had been, and that any time Reg was coming up to London, he must let him, Richard, know, and was there anything he could do to help about the horse? No? Well, all right then, if you're sure, and thank you again so much. He stood there for a moment or two after the door finally closed, pondering things. He had noticed during a short time that the light from Reg's room flooded out onto the landing of the main staircase, that there were no marks on the floorboards there at all. It seemed odd that the horse should only have scuffed the floorboards inside Reg's room. Well, it all seemed very odd, full stop. But here was yet another curious fact to add to the growing pile. This was supposed to have been a relaxing evening away from work. On an impulse, he knocked on the door opposite to Reg's. It took such a long time to be answered that Richard had given up and was turning to go when at last he heard the door creak open. He had a slight shock when he saw that staring sharply up at him like a small and suspicious bird was the Don with the racing yacht keel for a nose. Sorry, said Richard abruptly, but have you seen or heard a horse coming up the staircase tonight? The man stopped his obsessive twitching of his fingers. He cocked his head slightly on one side, and then seemed to need to go on a long journey inside himself to find a voice, which when found turned out to be a thin and soft little one. He said, "That is the first thing anybody has said to me for 17 years, 3 months, and 2 days, 5 hours, 19 minutes, and 20 seconds. I've been counting." He closed the door softly again. Richard virtually ran through second court. When he reached first court, he steadied himself and slowed down to a walking pace. The chill night air was rasping in his lungs, and there was no point in running. He hadn't managed to talk to Susan because Reg's phone wasn't working, and this was another thing that he had been mysteriously coy about. That at least was susceptible of a rational explanation. He probably hadn't paid his phone bill. Richard was about to emerge out onto the street, when instead he decided to pay a quick visit to the porter's lodge, which was tucked away inside the great archway entrance into the college. It was a small hutch-like place filled with keys, messages, and a single electric bar heater. A radio nattered to itself in the background. Excuse me, he said to the large, black-suited man standing behind the counter with his arms folded. Yes, Mr. Macduff, what can I do for you? In his present state of mind, Richard would have been hard-pressed himself to remember his own name and was startled for a moment. However, college porters are legendary for their ability to perform such feats of memory, and for their tendency to show them off at the slightest provocation. "Is there," said Richard, "a horse anywhere in the college that you know of. I mean, you would know if there was a horse in the college, wouldn't you? The porter didn't blink. No, sir, and yes, sir. Anything else I can help you with, Mr. Macduff, sir? No, said Richard, and tapped his fingers a couple of times on the counter. No, thank you. Thank you very much for your help. Nice to see you again, Bob, he hazarded. Good night, then. He left. The porter remained perfectly still, with his arms folded, but shaking his head a very, very little bit. Here's some coffee for you, Bill, said another porter, a short, wiry one, emerging from an inner sanctum with a steaming cup. Getting a bit colder tonight? I think it is, Fred, thanks, said Bill, taking the cup. He took a sip. You can say what you like about people, they don't get any less peculiar. Fellow in here just now asking if there was a horse in the college. Oh, yes. Fred sipped at his own coffee and let the steam smart his eyes. I had a chap in here earlier, a sort of strange foreign priest. Couldn't understand a word he said at first, but he seemed happy just to stand there by the fire and listen to the news on the radio. Foreigners, eh? In the end, I told him to shoot off, standing in front of my fire like that. Suddenly he says, is that really what he must do? Shoot off? I said in my best Bogart voice. You better believe it, buddy. Really? It sounded more like Jimmy Cagney to me. No, that's my Bogart voice. This is my Jimmy Cagney voice. You better believe it, buddy. Bill frowned at him. Is that your Jimmy Cagney voice? I always thought that was your Kenneth McKellar voice. You don't listen properly, Bill. You haven't got the ear. This is Kenneth McKellar. Oh, you take the high road and I'll take the low road. Oh, I see. I was thinking of the Scottish Kenneth McKellar. So, what did this priest fellow say then, Fred? Oh, he just looked at me straight in the eyes, Bill, and said in this strange sort of... Skip the accent, Fred. Just tell me what he said, if it's worth hearing. He just said he did believe me. So, not a very interesting story then, Fred. Well, maybe not. I only mentioned it because he also said that he'd left his horse in a washroom and would I see that it was all right. Chapter 11 Gordon Way drifted miserably along the dark road, or rather tried to drift. He felt that as a ghost, which is what he had to admit to himself he had become, he should be able to drift. He knew little enough about ghosts, but he felt that if you were going to be one, then there ought to be certain compensations for not having a physical body to lug around, and that among them ought to be the ability simply to drift. But no, it seemed he was going to have to walk every step of the way. His aim was to try and make it to his house. He didn't know what he would do when he got there, but even ghosts have to spend the night somewhere, and he felt that being in familiar surroundings might help. Help what? He didn't know. At least the journey gave him an objective, and he would just have to think of another one when he arrived. He trudged despondently from lamppost to lamppost, stopping at each one to look at bits of himself. He was definitely getting a bit wraith-like. At times he would fade almost to nothing, and would seem to be little more than a shadow playing in the mist, a dream of himself that could just evaporate and be gone. At other times he seemed to be almost solid and real again. Once or twice he would try leaning against a lamppost and would fall straight through it if he wasn't careful. At last, and with great reluctance, he actually began to turn his mind to what it was that had happened. Odd, that reluctance. He really didn't want to think about it. Psychologists say that the mind will often try to suppress the memory of traumatic events, and this, he thought, was probably the answer. After all, if having a strange figure jump out of the boot of your own car and shoot you dead didn't count as a traumatic experience, he'd like to know what did. He trudged on wearily. He tried to recall the figure to his mind's eye, but it was like probing a hurting tooth, and he thought of other things. Like, was his will up to date? He couldn't remember, and made a mental note to call his lawyer tomorrow, and then made another mental note that he would have to stop making mental notes like that. How would his company survive without him? He didn't like either of the possible answers to that very much. What about his obituary? There was the thought that chilled him to his bones, wherever they'd got to. Would he be able to get hold of a copy? What would it say? They'd better give him a good write-up, the bastards. Look at what he'd done. Single-handedly saved the British software industry. Huge exports, charitable contributions, research scholarships, crossing the Atlantic in a solar-powered submarine. Failed, but a good try. All sorts of things. They'd better not go digging up that Pentagon stuff again, or get his lawyer onto them. He made a mental note to call him in the mor... No. Anyway, can a dead person sue for libel? Only his lawyer would know, and he was not going to be able to call him in the morning. He knew, with a sense of creeping dread, that of all the things he had left behind in the land of the living, it was the telephone he was going to miss the most. And then he turned his mind determinedly back to where it didn't want to go. The figure. It seemed to him that the figure had been almost like a figure of death itself. or was that his imagination playing tricks with him? Was he dreaming that it was a cowled figure? What would any figure, whether cowled or just casually dressed, be doing in the boot of his car? At that moment, a car zipped past him on the road and disappeared off into the night, taking its oasis of light with it. He thought with longing of the warm, leather-upholstered, climate-controlled comfort of his own car, abandoned on the road behind him. And then a sudden, extraordinary thought struck him. Was there any way he could hitch a lift? Could anyone actually see him? How would anyone react if they could? Well, there was only one way to find out. He heard another car coming up in the distance behind him, and turned to face it. The twin pools of hazy lights approached through the mist, and Gordon gritted his phantom teeth and stuck his thumb out at them. The car swept by regardless. Nothing. Angrily, he made an indistinct V-sign at the receding red rear lights, and realized, looking straight through his own upraised arm, that he wasn't at his most visible at the moment. Was there perhaps some effort of will he could make to render himself more visible when he wanted to? He screwed up his eyes in concentration, then realized he would need to have his eyes open in order to judge the results. He tried again, forcing his mind as hard as he could, but the results were unsatisfactory. Though it did seem to make some kind of rudimentary glowing difference, he couldn't sustain it, and it faded almost immediately, however much he piled on the mental pressure. He would have to judge the timing very carefully if he was going to make his presence felt, or at least seen. Another car approached, from behind, travelling fast. He turned again, stuck his thumb out, waited till the moment was right, and willed himself visible. The car swerved slightly, then carried on its way, only a little more slowly. Well, that was something. What else could he do? He would go and stand under a lamppost for a start, and he would practice. The next car he would get for sure. Chapter 12. So, if you'd like to leave a message, I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Maybe. Beep. Shit, damn, hold on a minute, blast, look up, click. Richard pushed the phone back into its cradle and slammed his car into reverse for 20 yards to have another look at the signpost by the road junction he just sped past in the mist. He had extracted himself from the Cambridge one-way system by the usual method, which involved going round and round it faster and faster until he achieved a sort of escape velocity and flew off at a tangent in a random direction, which he was now trying to identify and correct for. Arriving back at the junction, he tried to correlate the information on the signpost with the information on the map, but it couldn't be done. The road junction was quite deliberately sitting on a page divide on the map, and the signpost was revolving maliciously in the wind. Instinct told him that he was heading in the wrong direction, but he didn't want to go back the way he'd come for fear of getting sucked back into the gravitational whirlpool of Cambridge's traffic system. He turned left, therefore, in the hope of finding better fortune in that direction, but after a while lost his nerve and turned a speculative right, and then chanced another exploratory left, and after a few more such manoeuvres was thoroughly lost. He swore to himself and turned up the heating in the car. If he had been concentrating on where he was going, rather than trying to navigate and telephone at the same time, he told himself, he would at least know where he was now. He didn't actually like having a telephone in his car. He found it a bother and an intrusion, but Gordon had insisted, and indeed had paid for it. He sighed in exasperation, backed up the black Saab, and turned around again. As he did so, he nearly ran into someone lugging a body into a field. At least, that was what it looked like for a second to his overwrought brain, but in fact it was probably a local farmer with a sack full of something nutritious. Though what he was doing with it on a night like this was anyone's guess. As his headlights swung round again, they caught for a moment a silhouette of the figure trudging off across the field with the sack on his back. Rather him than me, thought Richard grimly, and drove off again. After a few minutes, he reached a junction with what looked a little more like a main road, nearly turned right down it, but then turned left and said there was no signpost. He poked at the buttons on his phone again. Get back to you as soon as possible. Maybe. Beep. Susan, it's Richard. Where do I start? What a mess. Look, I'm sorry, sorry, sorry. I screwed up very badly, and it's all my fault. And look, whatever it takes to make up for it, I'll do it. Solemn promise. He had a slight feeling that this wasn't the right tone to adopt with an answering machine, but he carried straight on. Honestly, we can go away. We take a holiday for a week, or even just this weekend, if you like. Really, this weekend, we'll go somewhere sunny. Doesn't matter how much pressure Gordon tries to put on me, and you know the sort of pressure he can muster. He is your brother, after all. I'll just, actually, it might have to be next weekend. Damn, damn, damn. It's just that I really have promised to get... No, look, it doesn't matter. We'll just do it. I don't care about getting Anthem finished for Comdex. It's not the end of the world. We'll just go. Gordon will just have to take a running jump. Gah! Richard swerved wildly to avoid the spectre of Gordon Way, which suddenly loomed in his headlights and took a running jump at him. He slammed on the brakes, started to skid, tried to remember what it was you were supposed to do when you found yourself skidding. He knew he'd seen it on some television programme about driving. He'd seen ages ago. What was the programme? God, he couldn't even remember the title of the programme, let alone, oh yes, they said you mustn't slam on the brakes. That was it. The world swung sickeningly round him with slow and appalling force as the car slewed across the road, spun, thudded against the grass verge, then slithered and rocked itself to a halt, facing the wrong way. He collapsed, panting, against the steering wheel. He picked up the phone from where he'd dropped it. "Susan," he gasped, "I'll get back to you," and hung up. He raised his eyes. Standing full in the glare of his headlights was the spectral figure of Gordon Way, staring straight in through the windscreen with ghastly horror in its eyes, slowly raising its hand and pointing at him. He wasn't sure how long he just sat there. The apparition had melted from view in a few seconds, but Richard simply sat, shaking, probably for not more than a minute, until a sudden squeal of brakes and glare of lights roused him. He shook his head. He was, he realized, stopped in the road, facing the wrong way. The car that had just screeched to an abrupt halt, almost bumper to bumper with him, was a police car. He took two or three deep breaths, and then, stiff and trembling, he climbed out and stood up to face the officer, who was walking slowly towards him, silhouetted in the police car's headlights. The officer looked him up and down. "I'm sorry, officer," said Richard, with as much calmness as he could wrench into his voice. I skidded. The roads are slippery, and I skidded. I spun round, as you see. I'm facing the wrong way." He gestured at his car to indicate the way it was facing. "Might you tell me why it was you skidded then, exactly, sir?" The police officer was looking him straight in the eye while pulling out a notebook. "Well, as I said," explained Richard, "the roads are slippery because of the mist, and, well, to be perfectly honest," he suddenly found himself saying, in spite of all his attempts to stop himself, "I was just driving along, and I suddenly imagined that I saw my employer throwing himself in front of my car." The officer gazed at him levelly. "Guilt complex, officer," added Richard with a twitch of a smile. "You know how it is. I was contemplating taking the weekend off." The police officer seemed to hesitate, balanced on a knife edge between sympathy and suspicion. His eyes narrowed a little, but didn't waver. "Been drinking, sir?" "Yes," said Richard with a quick sigh, but very little. 2 glasses of wine, max, and a small glass of port. Absolute max. It was really just a lapse of concentration. I'm fine now." "Name?" Richard gave him his name and address. The policeman wrote it all down carefully and neatly in his book, then peered at the car registration number and wrote that down too. "And who is your employer then, sir?" "His name's Way, Gordon Way." "Oh," said the policeman, raising his eyebrows. "The computer gentleman." Yes, that's right. I design software for the company, WayForward Technologies too." "We've got one of your computers down the station," said the policeman. "Bug it if I can get it to work." "Oh," said Richard wearily, "which model do you have?" "I think it's called a Quark 2. "Oh, well, that's simple," said Richard with relief. "It doesn't work. Never has. The thing is a heap of shit." "Funny thing, sir. That's what I've always said," said the policeman. "Some of the other lads don't agree." "Oh, well, you're absolutely right, officer. The thing is hopeless. It's the major reason the original company went bust. I suggest you use it as a big paperweight." "Well, I wouldn't like to do that, sir," the policeman persisted. "The door would keep blowing open." "What do you mean, officer?" asked Richard. "I use it to keep the door closed, sir. Nasty drafts down our station this time of year. In the summer, of course, we beat suspects around the head with it." He flipped his book closed and prodded it into his pocket. "My advice to you, sir, is to go nice and easy on the way back. Lock up the car and spend the weekend getting completely pissed. I find it's the only way. Mind how you go now." He returned to his car, wound down the window, and watched Richard manoeuvre his car around and drive off into the night before heading off himself. Richard took a deep breath, drove calmly back to London, let himself calmly into his flat, clambered calmly over the sofa, sat down, poured himself a stiff brandy, and began seriously to shake. There were 3 things he was shaking about. There was the simple physical shock of his near accident, which is the sort of thing that always churns you up a lot more than you expect. The body floods itself with adrenaline, which then hangs around your system turning sour. Then there was the cause of the skid, the extraordinary apparition of Gordon throwing himself in front of his car at that moment. Boy, oh boy! Richard took a mouthful of brandy and gargled with it. He put the glass down. It was well known that Gordon was one of the world's richest natural resources of guilt pressure, and that he could deliver a ton on your doorstep fresh every morning. But Richard hadn't realised he had let it get to him to such an unholy degree. He took up his glass again, went upstairs, and pushed open the door to his workroom, which involved shifting a stack of Bite magazines that had toppled against it. He pushed them away with his foot, and walked to the end of the large room. A lot of glass at this end let in views over a large part of North London, from which the mist was now clearing. St. Paul's glowed in the dark distance, and he stared at it for a moment or two, but it didn't do anything special. After the events of the evening, he found this came as a pleasant surprise. At the other end of the room were a couple of long tables, smothered in, at the last count, 6 Macintosh computers. In the middle was the Mac 2, on which a red wireframe model of his sofa was lazily revolving within a blue wireframe model of his narrow staircase, complete with banister rail, radiator, and fuse box details, and, of course, the awkward turn halfway up. The sofa would start out spinning in one direction, hit an obstruction, twist itself into another plane, hit another obstruction, revolve around a third axis until it was stopped again, then cycle through the moves again in a different order. You didn't have to watch the sequence for very long before you saw it repeat itself. The sofa was clearly stuck. 3 other Macs were connected up via long tangles of cable to an untidy agglomeration of synthesizers. An emulated 2+ HD sampler, a rack of TX modules, a Prophet VS, a Roland JX-10, a Korg DW-8000, an Octopad, a left-handed Synthax MIDI guitar controller, and even an old drum machine stacked up and gathering dust in the corner. Pretty much the works. There was also a small and rarely used cassette tape recorder. All the music was stored in sequencer files on the computers, rather than on tape. He dumped himself into a seat in front of one of the Macs to see what, if anything, it was doing. It was displaying an untitled Excel spreadsheet, and he wondered why. He saved it, and looked to see if he'd left himself any notes, and quickly discovered that the spreadsheet contained some of the data he'd previously downloaded after searching the World Reporter and Knowledge Online databases for facts about swallows. He now had figures which detailed their migratory habits, their wing shapes, their aerodynamic profile and turbulence characteristics, and some sort of rudimentary figures concerning the patterns that a flock would adopt in flight, but as yet he had only the faintest idea as to how he was going to synthesize them all together. Because he was too tired to think particularly constructively tonight, he savagely selected and copied a whole swathe of figures from the spreadsheet at random, pasted them into his own conversion program, which scaled and filtered and manipulated the figures according to his own experimental algorithms, loaded the converted file into Performer, a powerful sequencer program, and played the result through random MIDI channels to whichever synthesizers happened to be on at the moment. The result was a short burst of the most hideous cacophony, and he stopped it. He ran the conversion program again, this time instructing it to force map the pitch values into G minor. This was a utility he was determined in the end to get rid of, because he regarded it as cheating. If there was any basis to his firmly held belief that the rhythms and harmonies of music which he found most satisfying could be found in, or at least derived from, the rhythms and harmonies of naturally occurring phenomena, then satisfying forms of modality and intonation should emerge naturally as well, rather than being forced. For the moment, though, he forced it. The result was a short burst of the most hideous cacophony in G minor. So much for random shortcuts. The first task was a relatively simple one, which should be simply to plot the waveform described by the tip of a swallow's wing as it flies, then synthesize that waveform. That way he would end up with a single note, which would be a good start, and shouldn't take more than the weekend to do. Except, of course, that he didn't have a weekend available to do it in, because he had somehow to get version 2 of Anthem out of the door sometime during the course of the next year, or month, as Gordon called it. Which brought Richard inexorably to the third thing he was shaking about. There was absolutely no way that he could take the time off this weekend or next to fulfil the promise he had made to Susan's telephone answering machine. And that, if this evening's debacle had not already done so, would surely spell the final end. But that was it. The thing was done. There is nothing you can do about a message on someone else's answering machine other than let events take their course. It was done. It was irrevocable. An odd thought suddenly struck him. It took him by considerable surprise, but he couldn't really see what was wrong with it. Chapter 13. A pair of binoculars scanning the London night skyline. Idly, curious, snooping. A little look here, a little look there, just seeing what's going on. Anything interesting, anything useful. The binoculars settle on the back of one particular house, attracted by a slight movement. One of those large, late Victorian villas, probably flats now. Lots of black iron drain pipes, green rubber dustbins, but dark. Nope, nothing. The binoculars are just moving onwards when another slight movement catches in the moonlight. The binoculars refocus, very slightly, trying to find a detail, a hard edge, a slight contrast in the darkness. The mist has lifted now, and the darkness glistens. They refocus a very, very little more, There it is, something, definitely, only this time a little higher up, maybe a foot or so, maybe a yard. The binoculars settle and relax. Steady, trying for the edge, trying for the detail. There. The binoculars settle again. They have found their mark, straddled between a windowsill and a drainpipe. It is a dark figure, splayed against the wall, looking down, looking for a new foothold, looking upwards, looking for a ledge. The binoculars peer intently. The figure is that of a tall, thin man. His clothes are right for the job, dark trousers, dark sweater, but his movements are awkward and angular. Nervous. Interesting. The binoculars wait and consider. Consider and judge. The man is clearly a rank amateur. Look at his fumbling, look at his ineptitude. His feet slip on the drainpipe, his hands can't reach the ledge. He nearly falls, he waits to catch his breath. For a moment, he starts to climb back down again, but seems to find that even tougher going. He lunges again for the ledge, and this time catches it. His foot shoots out to steady himself and nearly misses the pipe. Could have been very nasty indeed. But now the way is easier and progress is better. He crosses to another pipe, reaches a third-floor window ledge, flirts briefly with death as he crawls painfully onto it, and makes the cardinal error and looks down. He sways briefly and sits back heavily. He shades his eyes and peers inside to check that the room is dark, and sets about getting the window open. One of the things that distinguish the amateur from the professional is that this is the point when the amateur thinks it would have been a good idea to bring along something to prise the window open with. Luckily for this amateur, the householder is an amateur too, and the sash window slides grudgingly up. The climber crawls with some relief inside. He should be locked up for his own protection, think the binoculars. A hand starts to reach for the phone. At the window, a face looks back out and for a moment is caught in the moonlight. And then it ducks back inside to carry on with its business. The hand stays hovering over the phone for a moment or two, while the binoculars wait and consider, consider and judge. The hand reaches instead for the A to Z street map of London. There is a long, studious pause, a little more intent binocular work, and then the hand reaches for the phone again, lifts it, and dials. Chapter 14. Susan's flat was small but spacious, which was a trick, reflected Richard tensely as he turned on the light, that only women seem able to pull off. It wasn't that observation which made him tense, of course. He'd thought it before, many times. Every time he'd been in her flat, in fact. It always struck him, usually because he had just come from his own flat, which was four times the size and cramped. He had just come from his own flat this time, only via a rather eccentric route, and it was this that made his usual observation unusually tense. Despite the chill of the night, he was sweating. He looked back out of the window, turned and tiptoed across the room, where the telephone and the answering machine stood on their own small table. There was no point, he told himself, in tiptoeing. Susan wasn't in. He would be extremely interested in knowing where she was, in fact, just as she, he told himself, had probably been extremely interested in knowing where he had been at the beginning of the evening. He realized he was still tiptoeing. He hit his leg to make himself stop doing it, but carried on doing it nonetheless. Climbing up the outside wall had been terrifying. He wiped his forehead with the arm of his oldest and greasiest sweater. There had been a nasty moment when his life had flashed before his eyes, but he'd been too preoccupied with falling and had missed all the good bits. Most of the good bits had involved Susan, he realized. Susan or computers. Never Susan and computers. Those had largely been the bad bits. Which was why he was here, he told himself. He seemed to need convincing, and told himself again. He looked at his watch. 11:45. It occurred to him he'd better go and wash his wet and dirty hands before he touched anything. It wasn't the police he was worried about, but Susan's terrifying cleaner. She would know. He went into the bathroom, turned on the light switch, wiped it, and then stared at his own startled face in the bright neon-lit mirror as he ran the water over his hands. For a moment he thought of the dancing warm candlelight of the Coleridge dinner, and the images of it welled up out of the dim and distant past of the earlier part of the evening. Life had seemed easy then, and carefree, the wine, the conversation, simple conjuring tricks. He pictured the round, pale face of Sarah, pop-eyed with wonder. He washed his own face. He thought, beware, beware, his flashing eyes, his floating hair. He brushed his own hair. He thought, too, of the pictures hanging high in the darkness over their heads. He cleaned his teeth. The low buzz of the neon light snapped him back to the present, and he suddenly remembered with appalled shock that he was here in his capacity as burglar. Something made him look himself directly in the face in the mirror. Then he shook his head, trying to clear it. When would Susan be back? That, of course, would depend on what she was doing. He quickly wiped his hands and made his way back to the answering machine. He prodded at the buttons, and his conscience prodded back at him. The tape wound back for what seemed to be an interminable time, and he realized with a jolt that it was probably because Gordon had been in full flood. He had forgotten, of course, that there would be messages on the tape other than his own, and listening to other people's phone messages was tantamount to opening their mail. He explained to himself once again that all he was trying to do was to undo a mistake he had made before it caused any irrevocable damage. He would just play tinier snippets until he found his own voice. That wouldn't be too bad. He wouldn't even be able to distinguish what was being said. He groaned inwardly, gritted his teeth, and stabbed at the play button so roughly that he missed it and ejected the cassette by mistake. He put it back in and pushed the play button more carefully. Beep! Oh, Susan, hi, it's Gordon, said the answering machine. Just on my way to the cottage, it's a... He wound forward for a couple of seconds. Need to know that Richard is on the case. I mean, really on... Richard set his mouth grimly and stabbed at the fast-forward button again. He really hated the fact that Gordon tried to put pressure on him via Susan, which Gordon always stoutly denied he did. Richard couldn't blame Susan for getting exasperated about his work sometimes if this sort of thing was going on. Pick. Response. Make a note to Susan, would you please, to get an armed response sign made up with a sharp spike on the bottom at the right height for rabbits to see. What? Muttered Richard to himself, and his finger hesitated for a second over the fast-forward button. He had a feeling that Gordon desperately wanted to be like Howard Hughes, and if he could never hope to be remotely as rich, he could at least try to be twice as eccentric, an act, a palpable act. That's Secretary Susan at the office, not you, of course, continued Gordon's voice on the answering machine. Where was I? Oh, yes, Richard and Anthem too. Susan, that thing has got to be in beta testing in two... Richard stabbed at the fast-forward, tight-lipped. Point is that there's only one person who's really in a position to know if he's getting the important work done, or if he's just dreaming, and that one person... He stabbed angrily again. He had promised himself he wouldn't listen to any of it, and now here he was getting angry at what he was hearing. He should really just stop this. Well, just one more try. When he listened again, he just got music. Odd. He wound forward again and still got music. Why would someone be phoning to play music to an answering machine, he wondered. The phone rang. He stopped the tape and answered it, then almost dropped the phone like an electric eel as he realized what he was doing. Hardly daring to breathe, he held the telephone to his ear. Rule one in housebreaking, said a voice. Never answer the phone when you're in the middle of a job. Who are you supposed to be, for heaven's sake? Richard froze. It was a moment or two before he could find where he had put his voice. Who is this? He demanded at last in a whisper. Rule two, continued the voice. Preparation. Bring the right tools. Bring gloves. Try to have the faintest glimmering of an idea of what you're about before you start dangling from window ledges in the middle of the night. Rule three. Never forget rule two. Who is this? Exclaimed Richard again. The voice was unperturbed. Neighbourhood watch, it said. If you just look out of the back window, you'll see. Trailing the phone, Richard hurried over to the window and looked out. A distant flash startled him. Rule four. Never stand where you can be photographed. Rule five. Are you listening to me, Macduff? What? Yes, said Richard in bewilderment. How do you know me? Rule five. Never admit to your name. Richard stood silent, breathing hard. I run a little course, said the voice, if you're interested. Richard said nothing. You're learning, continued the voice. Slowly, but you're learning. If you were learning fast, you would have put the phone down by now, of course, but you're curious and incompetent, and so you don't. I don't run a course for novice burglars, as it happens. Tempting, though the idea is, I'm sure there would be grants available. If we have to have them, they may as well be trained. However, if I did run such a course, I would allow you to enroll for free, because I too am curious. Curious to know why Mr. Richard Macduff, who I am given to understand is now a wealthy young man, something in the computer industry, I believe, should suddenly be needing to resort to housebreaking. Who? So, I do a little research, phone directory inquiries, and discover that the flat into which he is breaking is that of a Miss S. Way. I know that Mr. Richard Macduff's employer is the famous Mr. G. Way, and I wonder if they can, by any chance, be related. Who? You are speaking with Sflad, commonly known as Dirk Chaley,
currently trading under the name of Gently, for reasons which it would be otiose at this moment to rehearse. I bid you good evening. If you wish to know more, I will be at the Pizza Express in Upper Street in 10 minutes. Bring some money.
Dirk! Exclaimed Richard. You? Are you trying to blackmail me?
No, you fool, for the pizzas. There was a click, and Dirk Gently rang off. Richard stood transfixed for a moment or two, wiped his forehead again, and gently replaced the phone, as if it were an injured hamster. His brain began to buzz gently and suck its thumb. Lots of little synapses deep in his cerebral cortex all joined hands and started dancing around and singing nursery rhymes. He shook his head to try and make them stop, and quickly sat down at the answering machine again. He fought with himself over whether or not he was going to push the play button again, and then did so anyway before he had made up his mind. Hardly 4 seconds of light orchestral music had oozed soothingly past when there came the sound of a key scratching in the lock out in the hallway. In panic, Richard thumped the eject button, popped the cassette out, rammed it into his jeans pocket, and replaced it from the pile of fresh cassettes that lay next to the machine. There was a similar pile next to his own machine at home. Susan at the office provided them. Poor, long-suffering Susan at the office. He must remember to feel sympathy for her in the morning, when he had the time and concentration for it. Suddenly, without even noticing himself doing it, he changed his mind. In a flash, he popped the substitute cassette out of the machine again, replaced the one he had stolen, rammed down the rewind button, and made a lunge for the sofa, where, with 2 seconds to go before the door opened, he tried to arrange himself into a nonchalant and winning posture. On an impulse, he stuck his left hand up behind his back, where it might come in useful. He was just trying to arrange his features into an expression composed in equal parts of contrition, cheerfulness, and sexual allurement, when the door opened and in walked Michael Wenton Weeks. Everything stopped. Outside, the wind ceased. Owls halted in mid-flight. Well, maybe they did, maybe they didn't. Certainly the central heating chose that moment to shut down, unable perhaps to cope with the supernatural chill that suddenly seemed to whip through the room. "What are you doing here, Wednesday?" demanded Richard. He rose from the sofa as if levitated with anger. Michael Wenton Weeks was a large, sad-faced man, known by some people as Michael Wednesday Week, because that was when he usually promised to have things done by. He was dressed in a suit that had been superbly well-tailored when his father, the late Lord Magna, had bought it 40 years previously. Michael Wenton Weeks came very high on the small but select list of people whom Richard thoroughly disliked. He disliked him because he found the idea of someone who was not only privileged, but was also sorry for himself because he thought the world didn't really understand the problems of privileged people, deeply obnoxious. Michael, on the other hand, disliked Richard for the fairly simple reason that Richard disliked him and made no secret of it. Michael gave a slow and lugubrious look back out into the hallway as Susan walked through. She stopped when she saw Richard. She put down her handbag, unwound her scarf, unbuttoned her coat, slipped it off, handed it to Michael, walked over to Richard, and smacked him in the face. "I've been saving that up all evening," she said furiously, "and don't pretend that's a bunch of flowers you've forgotten to bring which you're hiding behind your back. You tried that gag last time." She turned and stalked off. "It's a box of chocolates I forgot this time," said Richard glumly, and held out his empty hand to her retreating back. "I climbed up the entire outside wall without them. Did I feel a fool when I got in?" "Not very funny," said Susan. She swept into the kitchen and sounded as if she was grinding coffee with her bare hands. For someone who always looked so neat and sweet and delicate, she packed a hell of a temper. "It's true," said Richard, ignoring Michael completely. "I nearly killed myself." "I'm not going to rise to that," said Susan from within the kitchen. "If you want something big and sharp thrown at you, why don't you come in here and be funny?" "I suppose it'll be pointless saying I'm sorry at this point," Richard called out. "You bet," said Susan, sweeping back out of the kitchen again. She looked at him with her eyes flashing and actually stamped her foot. "Honestly, Richard," she said, "I suppose you're going to say you forgot again. How can you have the gall to stand there with two arms, two legs and a head as if you're a human being? This is behaviour that a bout of amoebic dysentery would be ashamed of. I bet that even the very lowest form of dysentery amoeba shows up to take its girlfriend out for a quick trot around the stomach lining once in a while. Well, I hope you had a lousy evening." "I did," said Richard. "You wouldn't have liked it. There was a horse in the bathroom, and you know how you hate that sort of thing." "Oh, Michael," said Susan brusquely, "don't just stand there like a sinking pudding. Thank you very much for dinner and the concert. You were very sweet, and I did enjoy listening to your troubles all evening because they were such a nice change from mine. But I think it'd be best if I just found your book and pushed you out. I've got some serious jumping up and down and ranting to do, and I know how it upsets your delicate sensibilities."